Welcome to As the Key Turns. I'm David Lehman. I'm a former guard at USP Marion, the first Supermax prison in America, where I worked for 23 years. I knew the subject of this series while he was a prisoner in K Unit of Marion. This will be the first part about Bernard C. Welch, prisoner number 06016-016. He spent years in the first Communications Management Unit in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. This special unit was known as K Unit. Only special guards were assigned to this exclusive unit. There were 8 cells, and they held spies and other profile prisoners, who embarrassed the government in one way or another. When I met Welch in K Unit, he was doing 143 years to life on 11 charges. He had been flown there from a county jail under heavy guard, where he had been arrested for a parking violation. He was in the Witness Protection Program. Both he and another Witness Protection Program ghost prisoner, Sonny Burkett, once sued the government and bragged about how much it cost in extra security and transportation. This video will be what I like to call a deep dive into the life and crimes that led to his dying in prison at age 57. Let me get this part out of the way. I did not like Welch. I had no respect for the man. He was a selfish psychopath who cared nothing for anybody but his own comfort. The amount of pain and death he caused during his criminal career is inestimable. But having said that, I do admit he was very good at what he did. He was a thief and a burglar. The cops said catching him was like catching a ghost. He just vanished. He was born the 28th of April, 1940, in Rochester, New York. Guinevere and Bernard were his parents. His father served in the war, and after the war, he got a job working for the filmmaker Eastman Kodak. They moved to a government-built housing project that was for veterans. Each government apartment was 800 square feet, 2 bedrooms and 1 bath on a slab foundation, and block walls. Not luxury living, but it kept them warm and dry. His sister Marilyn was born in 1946. His father was a violent drunk, and his mother was an eccentric woman who lived inside of a fantasy world. The two kids had to fend for themselves in the housing project without supervision, a park to play in or a town pool. They had a few broken toys and some secondhand clothes. Dad also had a gambling problem, and Mom stayed at home. There wasn't much left over for, good time trips or gifts for the kids. In 1951, the family moved to a house in Spencerport, New York. The house was old and in dire need of repair, and, it never got done. There was no running water or toilet. There was a hand pump in the kitchen that had iron and sulfur in heavy doses in the water. It smelled like rotten eggs. There was an outhouse in the backyard. Every day, Bernie and his family, family called him Bernie, went to the corner store and hauled back 2 buckets of water for the drinking and the cooking. To make ends meet, little Bernie and his sister took to stealing. They dug up potatoes at night, milked cows at dawn, and stole candy from the store. The problem with the theft of all this candy was tooth decay. With his family's money going to alcohol and gambling, there wasn't much left over for a trip to the dentist for some kid. He didn't do well in school and was constantly in trouble. Finally, he gave up and quit when he was in the 9th grade. He was just 16 years old. He spent his free time hunting and trapping. Not all of it was legal, and he was caught with a deer he had shot out of season. In the winter of 1957, he moved out of the family house and went to Adirondack Park near the mountains of the same name. He lived in a tent, trapped and hunted pelts to sell. While he was at it, he stole stuff when nobody was around and broke into a few summer cabins. He was never caught for any of this petty thefts. He used the money he made that winter to buy a Thunderbird Ford car. Welch learned to be a plumber while he worked at the plumbing supply store. He did jobs and learned the craft, to earn a living. But this was just cover for his real intentions. He cased the houses he worked on. found out where the valuables were and how to shut down the phones and alarms if they had any. He was the perfect spy, collecting information while pretending not to be interested at all. Welch hated his father's gambling with cards. He learned the art of reading people. In poker, you want to know what the other man is holding and what's he going to do with it. The same for a burglar. He could read his potential victims and predict their future behavior. Good to know if a family didn't believe in banks and kept all the jewels and cash at home. He became very adroit at reading people from their mannerisms, body language, and of course what they said. In 1963, Welch met his wife and partner in crime, Annie Marie Hulbert. She was a bit shocked at first learning he was a burglar, but soon decided to help him. She would drive him to the area where he would break into a house. A couple hours later, she would meet him and pick him up at some point about 3 blocks from the house he'd just burglarized. He took small items that he could conceal on his person, things like gold and silver coins, guns, and jewelry. He never disposed of the loot with a fence, because a fence will sell his soul to the cops for a lighter sentence when he's caught. His preferred method of sale was direct to the customer. He went to flea markets and sold his stuff. The cops never checked on the goods being sold in flea markets, and the customer couldn't remember who they bought the thing from if it turned out to be stolen later. A gun could be sold on the street at a higher price than retail to people who couldn't get one in the store. He made a mistake and burglarized the flea market he was selling stolen goods at. The cops were on to him. They just didn't have enough for an arrest yet. Welch came home, told his wife to pack, and they were on the road with a U-Haul full of stolen goods to, you know, out of New York. They landed in West Virginia. He decided to open an antique store. It was the perfect place to sell his stolen goods. He got top dollar, cut out the fence, and potential squealer. Not to mention, it made him appear to be a successful business owner. It gave him an excuse for all the income from prying eyes. But the ruse didn't work. Bernard C. Welch was wanted in New York for burglary and grand theft. A customer in town noticed her silver set for sale in the store that Welch personally worked at. The cops came around and verified the possession of stolen property and was part of the investigation. They did a background check. He was sent back to New York on the warrants. He was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison at the Auburn Correction Facility starting in April of 1966. His wife got probation for being an accessory to burglary. Welch served only 18 months of his 5-year sentence. It was the best 18 months he had to date. He got his teeth fixed and the chronic pain was gone. He exercised and got strong and healthy. He afforded himself of the prison education program and got his GED. Most importantly for him, he was able to study the fine art of burglary and other cons. He learned that disposing of the loot was the issue. That is what got him caught anyway. Coins had no special markings and could not be identified. Collectors rarely questioned where the buyer got the coin. Most gold and silver items were worth the value of the metal, not what they had been fashioned into. The tea set that got him caught and sent to prison was just as valuable, you know, if it was melted down into a bar, as it was as a tea set. But a melted bar couldn't be traced to the victim. He spent a lot of time in the prison library and studied business and investing. He wanted to be able to discuss these subjects with potential victims as if he was from the upper strata of society. He knew if he was able to ingratiate himself in the circles of the upper crust, he could be in a position to gain information that would help him victimize people with a lot of wealth. Robbing the poor was very dangerous and unprofitable. After his release from prison in New York, he went back to West Virginia to face the charges of the tea set. He got 3 years probation on the conviction and was set free. He moved back to New York. He bought a house on Brick Schoolhouse Road in Hamlin, New York, and got a job working for the Eastman Kodak as a steam fitter with his dad. His time in prison taught him a lot about being a professional criminal. He knew that he had been an amateur before, this next phase of his life would be different. He would conduct himself as a professional high-end burglar. He first had to get another identity, one he could dispose of if attention was brought to him. He was Bernard Miles on his fake ID. He used this alias to rent spaces at flea markets where he could sell his stolen goods for about 75% of its value, much higher than the 10% a fence would give him. He rented a storage unit to store his stolen merchandise. He figured it was safer than keeping it at his home where it could be linked to him. If in the future, all his burglaries would be committed at least an hour's drive from where he lived, and the stuff sold 3 or more hours away. He even advertised the stuff in local newspapers, 3 or 4 counties distant from where it was stolen. His wife couldn't stand the strain of being married to a master thief. She almost went to prison the last time he was caught. She took her 2 daughters and left Bernard. Later, she filed for divorce. Not long after, Welsh was caught selling stolen goods in Florida. He had taken some guns, and an observant cop on a pawn shop patrol, he used the national database to confirm the guns had been stolen in New York. The owner of the pawn shop put the finger on Welsh. The cops in New York got a warrant and arrested Welsh. They found the storage unit. In all, they had evidence Welsh had committed at least 100 burglaries in 6 counties of New York, and over $500,000 in stolen property was on him at the time of his arrest. Over 24 chiefs of police had burglaries cleared up by Bernard's arrest. The court was not pleased and gave him 10 years in the slammer. No charges were filed against his wife. She jumped ship just in time. This time he was sent to a hardcore maximum security prison in Attica, New York. Yes, that Attica. He had graduated to the big time school for criminals, and he would be given a postdoctoral education in criminal behavior. Attica was the home to over 2,500 of the state's worst criminals. Over 1/3 of the prisoners were there for violent crimes such as murder. Prisoners were killed by other prisoners as a matter of routine. To say it was a tough place is a gross understatement. Welsh was at Attica when the famous prison riot started with the killing of a guard. Attica was where Welsh first met members of the Aryan Brotherhood. He needed protection, and the ABs were quickly getting the reputation of a gang of savage killers. With them protecting him, nobody would dare touch him. He had an outside source holding money for him, and he directed her to send money to an AB associate on the outside. This little insurance policy paid off pretty big during the riot. Over 40 people were killed during the disturbance, but Bernard came out just fine for this small investment in protection. In 1974, after the riot, Welsh was moved to a lower security prison in Adirondack Correctional Treatment Center. It was a much easier place to escape from. On September 2nd, 1974, Welsh and another prisoner, a killer by the name of Maturino, hit the fence and fled into the forest of the Adirondack Park. Once outside, they spent a couple of days carefully sneaking through the woods till they found a house to burglarize for cash, clothes, and food. Next, they stole a car and hit the road. Near Utica, New York, they ran a police roadblock. They crashed the car into the roadblock and drove a short distance, crashed the car onto the side of the road, and ran into the woods on foot. By the time the cops recovered from the surprise, the pair was gone. Let me stop right here and talk about escaping from prison. Getting over the fence is the easy part, if you can believe that. The hard part is not getting recaptured. A fugitive has to have a plan to stay out of the spotlight of the long arm of the law. He can't seem out of place. He needs protection. And Welsh, he was no fool. I can tell you from years of observing him, he had a methodical mind and he could plan very well. It's what made him so dangerous and why K-Unit was there for him to begin with. Through Maturino, Welles tapped into a network of criminals that, for a price, would provide him what he needed, a new identity for the two of them, a place to hide out when the heat was on. This was also when Welles put all the criminal education to work. He had perfected the break-in. He knew exactly how to use Maturino as the wheel man to pick him up and drop him off when he went to work in somebody's house. He'd gotten a furnace to melt down the gold and silver he stole. The law had changed while he was in prison, and U.S. citizens were able to own bulk gold for the first time since the 1930s Depression law had forbidden it. Welles had gotten over his fear of banks with his new fake identity. He sold goods under his alias and was given a check by dealers he sold to. He deposited as much as $50,000 a month from sales of stolen property. He sold stuff using newspaper ads and built up a network of buyers who would pay cash, no questions asked. Maturino was never told what or where Welles got the stuff. He went out three or four nights a week, broke into as many as three houses a night. He was on a roll and was going to make the best of it while his luck held out. After 2 months of living with Maturino, Welles had all he needed to strike out on his own. He dumped his girlfriend, a school teacher that he picked up, dropped Marino off at a friend's house, and skipped town. And when he skipped town, he had enough cash and stolen merchandise to set him up in a new town with a new name. This time he stopped in Falls Church, Virginia, just outside Richmond, the former capital of the Confederate government. He met and moved in with another school teacher, Mary Boone. She had a comfortable house with a small garage in the back. It was a perfect garage to sort stolen property in. She didn't ask questions. She thought his name was Hank Snow. He rented a U-Haul now and then and transported his stuff to Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, to sell on consignment or on flea markets. The owner of Conestoga Auction Company, Walt Baumberger, didn't buy Welch's story. Walt noticed Welch didn't seem to know much about the Oriental rugs, art items, ceramics, expensive furniture, and jewelry he sold. He claimed to be the owner of what he bought at estate sales, but had no explanation why he would drive 6 hours from home to sell the stuff. It just didn't add up to a legitimate sale. Walt contacted the Pennsylvania Crime Commission. They listened to Walt and postulated that Myron H. Snow might have been part of an interstate crime syndicate. They contacted the Virginia State Police, who confirmed Myron H. Snow was a factory worker living in Charlottesville. The cops suspected that Myron H. Snow, selling things at auction, and the guy by the same name in Charlottesville were two different people. To find where the fake Mr. Snow was living, they decided to trail him to his house. The Pennsylvania police followed him to the Virginia border, where the other agency would take over the surveillance. What none of them knew was that Welch was a genius at detecting a trail. When he got home, he knew the cops were on to him. He quickly packed up all his cash and some of the more valuable stolen things in his car. He took a walk around the area of the house and was satisfied he was no longer observation, and hit the road. He left his schoolteacher girlfriend wondering what the hell had just happened. This time, he didn't flee that far. He landed in a motel in the Washington, D.C. area. While staying at the motel, he met Linda Hamilton, who lived in an apartment next door to the motel. He told her he was Norm Hyman, an investor in antique stores and gold coins. He was driving a new Chevrolet Monte Carlo. When they were on their first date, she noticed he was packing a pistol. She told him she was terrified of guns. He said he only had it because he often had gold and large amounts of cash. He made sure she never saw the gun again. Now, if you've enjoyed this video, then you're gonna love part two of this three-part series. Consider donating to my Patreon account at patreon.com/asthekeyturns. Don't forget to hit the like button, and I promise it won't kill you.